Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Unfortunately, Bobby Hart has passed away. He was aged 86. He passed away September 10th. He was a guest on the program twice, March 15th, 2014, and May 23rd, 2015. One of the nicest guests I ever had. You know, he got to Hollywood at a time when music was exploding and he was prolifically writing songs and got them to folks of so many different genres. All these different sorts of performers covered songs that he wrote or co-wrote. And so he got to cross paths with lots and lots of interesting folks. So it's a quite an interesting story to tell, and he will be missed. He put us on his Christmas card list and just kept in touch. And again, somebody I only have real positive thoughts about. So here it is, two interviews back to back, me and the late, great Bobby Hart. I love that version of that song. I don't think it's quite as good as the Boyce and Hart version, but it still blows my mind, maybe because it's such a great song. Joining us on the telephone, Bobby Hart, welcome to WFMU. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Hi, Michael. How's it going?
It's great. You know, that is a fantastic, terrific song. And and Gary Lewis does a fantastic version of it. Maybe I had Gary on the show a couple years ago, and he claims he plays drums on all his records and claims he has a letter from Bones Howe certifying that he plays drums on all his records. And then a few weeks later, I had Bones Howe on the program, and I said, does Gary play drums? And he goes, no, he doesn't play drums on any of those records. Are you nuts? We wouldn't let Gary near a drum set. He said maybe on a few album tracks. Anyway,
that's probably Hal Blaine. That's a version I've never heard before. I didn't know they cut that song.
Wow. So the checks haven't been rolling in for the Gary Lewis version of it. So, Bobby Hart, you were born in Phoenix, Arizona. Your father was a minister, and right out of the high school, you joined the Army. It doesn't seem like the typical background for the 60s showbiz guy. What happened?
Well, I didn't know I was going to be a show business guy. I thought I was going to be a disc jockey like you, and I wanted to get my Army service out of it when the draft was still in effect. So I went in for 6 months and did the reserve program so I could go to disc jockey school in Hollywood.
Huh. So you went to Hollywood, and how did you go from spinning records to thinking maybe I'll have a hand in making records?
Well, I was going to Don Martin School of Radio, 18 years old. And we used to pass this little recording studio that said, come in and see what your voice sounds like, $10. And one day I got up my nerve, and I did, and I was hooked. And I had a record deal within maybe about 4 months after that.
That is amazing. Some of the folks who have cut your songs, the Shangri-Las and Dean Martin and Jackie Shannon and Herman's Hermits and, of course, the Monkees, and the list kind of goes on and on. But one of the very early ones was Fats Domino and Chubby Checker. Tell how Fats Domino got to record your one of your earliest big, big successes.
Well, actually, it was a Tommy Boy song. I just met Tommy. We were both scuffling in Hollywood, trying to be recording artists and learning how to write at the same time. And he got this song to Fats through a friend of his, John Mariscalco, who had a lot of hits for Little Richard. So he got the song in, and Fats said, "Okay, I'd like to cut the song, but I'm going to take half the writing and all the publishing."
Is that how it worked back then? I mean, you always hear that. People just add their names to songs. And I was looking. There's a bunch of Boyce Hart songs that have co-writers on them. And I wonder, what is that very real, or is that just how it worked?
In the early days, it was real. And Tommy never regretted it because it got his foot in the door and helped us for the next stuff we started writing together. In fact, some of the Gary Lewis songs that we wrote has pseudonyms on there for Snuffy Garrett, the producer, and Leon Russell.
Huh. So guys like Fats Domino just look you in the eye and say, "Kitty, you want your song on the record, it's going to cost you half the publishing." That was just...
No, I don't think it was Fats himself, but his management would make the deals for him, and he was hot. Had been for 10 years. So
that is absolutely kind of mind-boggling. We should let everybody know, today you're at the Monkees Convention, and there's information at monkeesconvention2014.com. That's today and tomorrow at the Hilton in the Meadowlands, and then tomorrow at the Bell House in Brooklyn for a screening of this new movie called Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, the guys who wrote them. And some folks are already chiming in saying they've seen the movie and that it's terrific. So everybody I know is going to look forward to that. And a lot of our listeners are going to be at one of those two events this weekend, a big Monkees weekend.
I think you'll enjoy it. It's like a preview. It's not the final cut, but it's very close to it. And the first show today at the convention is sold out. There's a couple more, one at 7:30 and one at 9:30, something like that. But the Bell House is in Brooklyn, for those who don't know. It's 149 7th Street in Brooklyn. And the doors open at 2 and the show's at 3 on Sunday.
And there's information at bellhouseny.com. I want to ask you more about both of those things later, but tell me, so you guys are getting some cuts here and there, and am I right that you moved back to New York at a certain point in the early 60s?
Yeah, we had Tommy and I had our first success in New York. Tommy got a break to go back there before me, and I joined him in 63. And we wrote a couple of top tenors. We had our first hit together was Debbie Checker, a song called Lazy Elsie Molly. We went top 30 or something like that. And then we wrote Come a Little Bit Closer for Jay and the Americans, which was turned out to be their biggest record of all time.
Yeah, that's 1964, during the Beatles' time, when it's hard to get a song on the charts, you know?
I was told that the Beatles asked them to open for their shows for that tour. Jay and the Americans opened for some of the shows because of the success of Come a Little Bit Closer.
We heard a version by Jay and the Americans earlier in the program in Spanish. Again, one of those songs so good, there's no way to screw it up. When you guys wrote Come a Little Bit Closer, Be My Guest is a great song, and Lazy Elsie Molly is a good song, but this song kind of leaps out at you and sort of has a little more of a timeless perfectness. Did you guys know when you wrote this song, or did you know when you wrote some songs, hey, this has got to be a hit, I'm sure of it? Did you have that feeling?
Well, we really liked it a lot. We wrote it with a guy named Wes Farrell, and Wes had already had a couple of hits, but we just liked the song because the storyline was so funny that, the girl's coming on to him in the cafe, and then when her boyfriend comes back, then she's back with the boyfriend real quick, and the guy's out the door. It was fun to write.
Yeah, it's one of those songs, I've kind of noticed this in oldies radio, some songs have a longevity that's sort of larger than their actual hit status at the time of release. Some songs just don't survive in oldies format well, and that one probably gets played every single day.
Oh, nice.
You wrote Hurt So Bad. You co-wrote that with Teddy Randazzo. He's kind of a character. How did you hook up with him? And tell me about writing a song like that. How long did it take? Is it done on a piano? Is it collaborative? How does it work?
It was all of that. It was done in an hour break. I was one of Teddy's background singers, and we were in Vegas at the Thunderbird Lounge. And so we had an hour between shows, between sets. And he said, I need a new song. Teddy was producing Little Anthony. He had already had I'm on the Outside Looking In and Going Out of My Head, so he needed a new single. So we went upstairs in an abandoned ballroom that was cold and dark, and I found a piano, and we knocked it out in an hour. And he was back on. He was on the red eye the next night and cutting it with Anthony.
Wow, that's a good hour's work. And that's another one of those songs where the bones of the song are pretty solid, and it's been cut 100 times. You know, everybody just has something to put onto that a song like that.
I think it might be the only song that was top 10 three times, three different decades, three different artists.
Wow.
Little Anthony, and then the Letterman, and then Linda Ronstadt in 1980.
Yeah, it's just a great song. Tell me about your songwriter. So your percentage comes supposedly when record labels press up a record, they've got to give the songwriters the statutory mechanical rate per right. every single record sold.
Right.
And how honest, how crooked do you think the record companies have been with you?
Oh, I can't complain about the record companies. Of course, it's it's almost 50 years, some of these songs, so we don't have the airplay we used to be. There are fewer oldie stations around. But I was lucky enough, Tommy and I signed with Screen Gems Columbia Music in 1965, and so a lot of our stuff was in movies and TV, so that kind of stuff that was tied to visuals, that still gets played all around the world a lot. So that income is pretty steady.
So you guys finally, you moved to L.A., and you've got stuff with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and you're placing songs out there. And then 1966, the Monkees comes along. How did you guys get involved? I mean, did they go to all the groovy people and say, do you want to be a part of this? Or how did they pick you guys?
Well, because we were signed to Screen Gems, but we were on the West Coast, and most of the big operation and the big hit songwriters, like Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Mann and Weill and all of those people were in New York. And so we were sent over to meet with the producers of the show, who said, we want to do an American Beatles on television. And we said, we got it, we love it, and we're your guys, and we'll give you what you need. So we wrote the three songs for the pilot show. And then when the show came out, we got to produce the records as well.
And when you delivered the theme to the Monkees, did they blow their minds? I mean, did they go, this is so good? Were they so happy?
Yes, they were happy. The producers were happy. The group, not so much, especially Nesmith. He said, are you kidding? He said, the Beatles would never sing Hey, Hey with the Beatles.
I've read a lot about the Monkees. It seems in some ways that Mike Nesmith never got it, sort of. You know, I mean, God bless him, you know, for his contribution. Maybe that was his contribution, was to be the guy to constantly doubt it all. But
it's so funny because we've heard these interviews for years and the you know, secondhand stories of what Michael was saying about us. But when he was interviewed to be used in this Boyce and Hart documentary that we're screening today, he said some of the nicest things about us. And he said, yeah, maybe that wasn't the theme song I would have written, but I didn't know, I wouldn't have had any idea what to write. And it turned out to be, he was saying really nice things. So it was sweet that he's, 50 years later, he's
well, it's just funny that he says the Beatles wouldn't sing that. Yeah, but the Monkees weren't the Beatles, you know.
Right. And it was a television show.
Yeah, exactly. And that is one of the catchiest songs. It's one of my earliest musical memories, I was saying. You know, it's one of the very first things of music that got into my head and stayed there. And that's powerful. That is pretty powerful. So the Monkees explodes. I mean, it's giant. In some ways, it's as big as the Beatles. Did anybody know?
Nobody knew for sure what would happen, but Tommy and I felt we'd seen the example of when Ricky Nelson sang for the first time on the Ozzy and Harriet show. And I'm going back to most people don't know what I'm talking about, but combining the power of television with the power of records, we knew that was a wonderful formula, and we thought it was going to be big. We just didn't know how big.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Every week they get to put a couple new songs on TV, and then kids get to hear them. I mean, genius idea.
Yeah.
Last Train to Clarksville, number one in 1966. Again, was there a surprise? I mean, that it was going to be quite that big.
There was. We Donny Kirshner was kind of our boss, and he said of the first album that Tommy and I produced, he said, "I think this is the single," and he decided to put it out. Well, it was already making its way well up the charts before the show even went on the air. And then, of course, when the show hit, everything just took off bigger.
Yeah. You guys sort of had the Monkees market cornered. Did people now rush to get a piece of this incredible action?
That's right. Yeah, the New York writers who were not that interested when it was just a pilot and they didn't know much about it, if it was even going to be sold, they weren't contributing, but then, of course, when it exploded the way it did, then Donnie was able to interest all his New York writers, and, of course, pulled in a great Neil Diamond song for the second single. We had the B-side with Not Your Stepping Stone, but I'm a Believer was probably their biggest record of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, Carole King, all those people all of a sudden very interested in writing for the Monkees. Yeah. All of a sudden,
then they got into it. Then
yeah, not too big for that. So 1968. I wonder what she's doing tonight. Were you guys always harboring this thing? We need to get back into performing. We need to get back in, to be the faces behind this.
Well, we always wanted to be recording artists, and we had continued to release records individually on our own, with very little success to show for it. So after the success of the Monkees, when it came time for headquarters and the guys wanted to produce their own album, well, that was great. They went on to do that, and that gave us a chance then to accept one of the offers that we had from record companies to be artists together for the first time.
Yeah. So you're doing all this. You're out in Hollywood, and it is the crazy 60s. And I think in some ways, I think people, the Monkees kind of, I think from what I've read, some of them especially, were pretty good partiers and pretty notorious, to be at all the right houses at the right time. But they sort of avoided that sort of that motif. What did your father, the minister, think about your vocation?
My dad was always supportive. I don't think he knew too much about what I was doing, but one weekend in 68, they were going to make it Boyce and Hart Day in Alabama, and Screen Gems was sending a film crew for that weekend tour. And Tommy asked his dad to go along, and I asked my dad. So we took our dads down there, and when they saw the pandemonium and the crowds and the screaming and ripping our shirts off and all that, my dad was blown away. He couldn't believe what was going on. After that, he was my biggest fan.
Yeah, that's terrific. You guys did a lot of TV work. Boyce and Hart were, I guess, not all rock and rollers could say a few lines in front of a camera. And it got, you know, the fact that you guys were coherent, it was a, you know, just that was a bonus. So you guys were on a lot of television shows, and you kind of parlayed a lot of your popularity into doing political work and environmental work and you know, working for causes that you guys believed in, which not everybody did back then.
Well, we got involved through Joey Bishop, who had a talk show at the time, and he had us on the show a lot. He introduced us to this grassroots campaign to lower the voting age to 18 that was happening on the campuses of some of the universities. So they made us the co-chairs of that campaign, and Tommy and I went to Washington and met with our senators and representatives, and everybody was kind of behind it. So it wasn't a big deal. It was kind of a no-brainer. Everybody said, "Why not? There's more votes for everybody."
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe that people could get drafted to go to Vietnam but not vote. That really brought that issue sort of home to everybody.
It did, and that was one of the big catchphrases. But it was true, and we promoted it on the shows wherever we went, and on the radio interviews and the press and whatever, and it worked. You know, I'm not saying we did it single-handedly, but it was wonderful to be involved and look back and say we were part of getting a. Actually changing the Constitution of the United States.
I absolutely think Boyce and Hart were absolutely part of that. It's amazing. You know, you mentioned Joey Bishop. He's not the kind of swinging guy you think of, and those guys were, not all of them, but I think guys like Sinatra and that generation were a little threatened by the Beatles. They made fun of their hair and didn't quite know what to make of it. It took a while before those guys embraced the goodness of the songs. And
It did. Well, Sinatra made remarks about Elvis when he first came out, and then the Beatles. But I think later Joey was very supportive of Boyce and Hart. I can't believe that he had us on his late night talk show probably once a month for a good period of time, and one of our biggest friends and supporters. So, but Joey was a family man, even though he was considered part of Sinatra's Rat Pack. He was really a stay at home guy, and he'd have us over to watch the show sometimes after. And we became good friends.
So did you sort of feel that from record labels? And because we've talked to some guests on the program who talk about their experience of getting signed by a label in the early 60s. And, you know, maybe previous to signing rock bands, that label really had no experience. You know, they were Mitch Miller and those guys did not know what it was. But at a certain point, everybody raced around L.A. signing anybody with long hair, you know. That sort of transition always interests me, how record labels had to jump on that.
Well, I think the record industry has gone through changes all through the years, but I remember the first time I saw it happen, when I first became aware, well, maybe I could get a deal as a recording artist. There were probably four or five major labels at that time, or just before that. But then when rock and roll came in, I'm talking about Elvis and the doo-wops and so on, that changed everything, because little independent recording labels sprung up all around L.A., and all you had to do was try to get one hit and find the next Gene Vincent or the next, Ricky Nelson and sign them up real quick. And that's how I got a record deal when I first came to town within 6 months of hitting Hollywood.
And was it by someone who did not understand rock and roll music?
No, this was a guy who had success in the country field and understood rockabilly, and that's what he signed me as. My first single was a rockabilly single.
It's amazing. You've been everywhere and done so much. You know, it is really incredible. Just to remind everybody again, the Monkees Convention is today and tomorrow. It's monkeesconvention2014.com. It's at the Hilton Meadowlands, which is easy to get to from Manhattan or anywhere in New Jersey today and tomorrow. And I saw that Larry Storch is on the list of folks in attendance. Have you seen Larry Storch today?
I haven't seen him, but because I kind of been stuck at my own table there, but signing autographs, but I've heard that he's down the way, and I'm going to get a chance to go and visit some of the other tables on my way back down now.
So what is this like to sit there and have, you know, hundreds of people from, I'm assuming, all ages? I'm assuming the age sure. the age range is complete, from, you know, from 12-year-olds to 80-year-olds. What are they asking you? What do they want from you?
You know, they don't want anything except to shake my hand and maybe get an autograph and to thank me for the music over the years that has meant something to them. And that means a lot to me to hear that back from them and that them still, you know, some of the things Tommy and I created almost 50 years ago is still appreciated and still touches people.
Yeah. The Monkees are sort of a... one of those groups, like the Beatles, that people can't stop writing about. You know, they can't stop re-releasing every scrap of music they ever made. And write. People are so interested in that story and the behind-the-scenes story of the Monkees. Do you think that they are a misunderstood band, or is it pretty straightforward?
I don't think so much anymore. I think they came out, and then they had all this stuff that part of it was politically motivated by the group itself, that they were... Didn't play the instruments on the records and the manufactured image and all of that stuff. So they had that stigma for maybe five or seven years, but it didn't take long until people saw through that and said, well, everybody else has studio musicians on their albums too, and this music is pretty good. And by the time we went out with Dolan Jones' Voice and Heart, 10 years after the beginning of the Monkees, it was already starting to turn around and people were starting to give respect to the Monkees. And today, partly because they're still on those shows are shown on television somewhere in the world every day. So it keeps the music alive. People discover it anew, new generations discover it. And there's a real appreciation that it's developed. And they see them not as some manufactured group, but they see them as people who actually learned how to play their instruments and went out and had some of the great lead voices of the 60s era.
Absolutely, yeah. That's well put. Do you still write songs? Do you still do that?
I'm doing it a little, but the business has changed so much. Basically, I do it on, you know, when I'm commissioned to do something. I don't do things on spec. I have been writing my book for the last 2.5 years and hope to have that out by the spring. And so with the book out and the documentary out, I'll probably be doing some signings and some personal appearances that way, but not performing and not so much writing anymore.
Gotcha. Bell House, tomorrow. The doors are at 2 o'clock. The film shows at 3 o'clock, and it's Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, the guys who wrote them, is the name. And you say this is kind of a rough cut, and there's going to be some live Q&A. Is that right?
We'll do a Q&A after with the producers and the director and myself. And it is not a final cut, but I would say it's 95%, and they're trying to raise the money for the licensing to, you know, pay the people who own the music and some of the clips. But I think you'll enjoy it. There's a lot of film that nobody's ever seen before. A lot of my home movies are in there. So I think anybody who's interested in this subject, even if you don't know a lot about the Monkees or Boyce and Heart, if you enjoy that period, or that kind of music, I think you'll enjoy the film.
Yeah, if you look at the playlist for today's program, I've put a little link to a trailer for the documentary Boyce and Heart, the guys who wrote them. You can watch a little preview, and it seems like somebody got a shoebox from under their bed because there's some real old photographs and, you know, it looks like Super 8 film and all kinds of stuff that I think no one's probably ever seen before.
It's true. Andrew Sandoval, one of the producers, has a wide-ranging archive of stills, and I owned a 16mm Beaulieu camera during the heyday that we took everywhere, so we've got a lot of that footage and a lot of the clips from the shows, so it's fun. And then it covers a lot of the stuff we've talked about, that the LUV campaign to lower the voting age and the activism and the arc of our careers going from all the Monkees hits and then our own hits and then ending on a kind of sour note, but then getting back together with Davy Jones and Mickey Dolenz as a group in 1976. In fact, that's where the title came from. When we went out 75, 76, they didn't license us the name The Monkees, so we went out as Don Jones, Boyce and Hart, the guys who sang them and the guys who wrote them. Right. So that's where they got that from.
Today, the Monkees convention, and tomorrow at the Bell House. You know, it's going to be a beautiful day tomorrow, and it sounds like a great way to sort of spend part of the afternoon at the Bell House. Check out bellhouseny.com for information, and Bobby Hart will be there in person answering questions. And you seem like a very down-to-earth guy. What's the secret to not going crazy? Because some people did go crazy.
I don't know. I think, you know, I've been kind of on a spiritual journey my whole life, but I've gotten more serious about it in the last 30 years. And I think that helps keep me grounded, and I think my wife would hit me over the head if I got... my head got too big, you know.
That'll do it. All right. I've got the demo version of the song Words queued up here. I don't know. Are you familiar with this recording?
Yeah, I remember it. And it did come out in a package on Rhino, I believe,
right.
A year or two ago, called It's All Happening or something like that.
So tell me.
It was called, I forget the name of it now.
What was the demo process for you like for something like this?
That's where we learned to produce records, of course, because it allowed us to go in and do demonstration records. And that was always a fun project, a process for us. And we garnered a string of very impressive young studio musicians who hadn't broken into the big time. But we used them then when we went to produce the Monkees, and that automatically broke them into the big time. People like Louis Sheldon, who became one of the top Hollywood guitar players after playing his famous lick on Clarksville.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody copied that. Yeah. So, I mean, you made a demo like this, you'd make it in an hour or an afternoon? Or?
Oh, no, they'd give us, yeah, like an hour to do a demo.
Ah, so wow.
You'd go in and you'd teach it to the musicians real quick, and then either Tommy and I would go out and sing it down. And they were rough. I mean, it was not like you were producing a master for release. So they were rough, but they had to be close enough to demonstrate to a potential recording artist that this, oh yeah, this could sound pretty good if I did this, you know?
Yeah, this one I particularly love. It just has a little rawness to it, but you can absolutely hear that this song is dynamite, and it's going to be big for somebody. Bobby Hart, it's been real fascinating. Just great to talk to you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. You know your stuff, and it's been a real pleasure for me to talk to you. To see some of the people out at one of the screenings.
Yeah, we'll see you at the screening or today at the Monkees convention. Thank you, Bobby Hart.
Thanks, Michael.
Got to have the key change at the end. You know, you got to have. It's like this is why I love these records, because they're kitchen sink. You know, there's like whatever stop can be pulled out to put more hooks into the song will be used. And you know, these records are just, they just don't make records like this anymore. Of course. Boyce and Hart there, and Bobby Hart joins us on the telephone. Welcome back to the program, and good morning, Bobby Hart.
Good morning,
how are you?
Michael, great to be here.
You've got a brand-new book just came out called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And you've got this movie out, which is screening right here at WFMU's Monty Hall on Friday, Boyce and Hart, the guys who wrote them. There's a lot going on, but it started so early. The book tells... I'm going to let you talk soon. Don't worry. The book tells this amazing story of this kid from a small town trying to distinguish himself, literally dropped off at the corner of Hollywood and Vine at age 18 with $50. And this is the part that kind of gets me, with really no connections. You know, you're making records, just a couple months almost after that. It's an amazing story.
I didn't even have the dream when I got dropped off on the corner. I thought I was coming to go to disc jockey school and be like you, but I got sidetracked within a couple of months by a little sign on the recording studio that said, come in and see what your voice sounds like. Not your voice, your voice. And I all of a sudden shifted and decided, hey, I can be a rock and roll star.
Well, we heard that song earlier, Too Many Teardrops, one of your earlier works.
Oh.
But it's such a, you know, such a, again, a full production, and, you know, there's backgrounds, and there's that melodica, I think it's a melodica on there, and
yeah.
it's a big record. I mean, you can tell, was everybody just going for it in L.A. at that time? I mean, it seems like rock and roll was still sort of this new thing, and nobody knew how to grab the brass ring, sort of.
It was the infancy of rock and roll, and it was a big change because there had been like three or four record companies. That was it, just like it is now. And then when rock and roll came in, everybody and their brother started a little independent label, and they'd do great until they had a hit, and then they'd spend all this money to press the records, and then distributors wouldn't pay them, and they'd go out of business. Somebody else would pop up in the same spot.
You spoke with Joe Bielock earlier in the week, and yeah. Folks can check the archives for that. And you and I spoke at length just a couple of years ago.
Yep.
When the first cut of this movie was playing, and now it's the final cut, and like I said, it's playing Friday at Monty Hall, and I think it will sell out, and I advise folks to get tickets right now, and there's a link on the WFMU.org page where they can buy tickets for that.
Come out and see it. It's the only opportunity to see it. It's not released yet. It's just a preview for you guys.
And you'll be there answering questions and stuff like that, and maybe signing some
records. I'll be signing some books that night, so come down and grab a copy of A Psychedelic Bubblegum.
Yeah, it's a really interesting record, and it's a book, and it's one of those books where you don't really hold back. Although I have to say, there's not too much. You're one of the few guys who did not go drug crazy or drink crazy. I think in the whole book you take one tablet of drugs and have one alcoholic drink in the entire book.
Thank God, you know, some of our contemporaries didn't make it through those troubled waters, and I just feel fortunate.
I mean, you were the only sober guy in the room a lot of the time, especially with the monkeys. I think you know it's
the monkeys are still standing except for Davey, God bless him, and it wasn't because of drugs.
Yeah,
he left us.
Yeah, you talk about your work with the monkeys. Mike Nesmith comes off as not a jerk, but as like sort of a jerk. I don't know.
Your words, not mine.
Yes, they're my. Yeah, you don't say that. But he comes off as a guy who needs to kind of put his needle in everything, even when it's against his own best interest. Like he can't help himself.
Well, you know, I don't blame him. There was, you know, it was two guys, two actors who had learned how to become musicians, two musicians who had learned how to become actors. He was one of the musicians, and he wanted to have more of a say about the music, and of course it wasn't set up that way.
Yeah.
So it was a little pushback from the beginning.
The book tells sort of the struggle, the many struggles over the monkeys' music, and one thing that I did not know was that you guys wrote these great songs, but I guess it's Don Kirshner felt like you just hadn't earned your producer stripes, so he actually got Mickey Most to try to record some monkey stuff, and he got Snuff Garrett to try to do it, and he got Goffin and King to try to do it, and they all literally made recordings that just didn't work, and they finally went back to you guys. I had no idea of that stuff, because all those three teams of people have made some amazing pop records.
They had. They were great. They were the greatest record producers of our day at that time. The difference was that we'd been working on the project for almost a year, and we had thought of nothing else, eating and sleeping the monkeys' new project, and what it should sound like and what it should look like, and stocking songs, getting ready. And then when he took us off the project, it was devastating, but we hung in.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, they had to come crawling back to you. There is something in, you know, I've been listening to a lot of the Boyce and Hart records, and in some ways they are better produced than the monkeys. There's like a, you know, there's just such a, they're so arranged. You know, there's all these dynamics in the record and all these instruments coming in and out and parts and vocal parts, you know, and it sounds like this is really sort of what the monkeys could have been if you guys could have made all of the decisions. You know, it kind of gives me an insight as to what's missing almost from the monkeys' records.
Tommy and I were learning on the job. You know, we learned from doing demo records, and we got pretty good, and then we got our big break with the monkeys, and by the time we were doing Voice and Heart, doing ourselves as artists, maybe we were getting a little better, honing our craft.
Yeah, there's amazing, amazing records like that one we just heard. Just so huge, and they're huge in a way that records just aren't today. They're great. One of the thing, you know, you got married real young to your high school sweetheart. You had two kids, and you were juggling all these things. And one of the things I did not know about your past at all that I learned in this book, Psychedelic Bubblegum, is that you worked in Vegas with Teddy Randazzo, and you worked in sort of the clubs in L.A. and in the Valley.
Yep.
during that sort of, you know, the Johnny Rivers model of play from, you know, whatever, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Exactly.
And, I mean, what was that like? I mean, that, you know, you have this idea that it was just the most electric thing ever with the girls and the go-go and everybody, the teenagers, claiming their culture. What was those sets like?
Yeah, it was that time. Everything was shifting in L.A. especially was the forefront of it. The West Coast in particular, and it was great times with the twist craze and then with the harder music was starting to come in with the Doors and the Leaves and those guys,
It was fun times, and I thought, well, this is what show business is all about. But I soon realized that I could play those clubs the rest of my life and still be looking for my next paycheck the following week to pay the rent. And Tommy was right to convince me to come back to New York, back from New York to and off the road, and join him at Screen Gems and write songs.
Hmm. You had written some co-written hits, and you'd made your own records, and you had some publishing deals where you were making like $50 a month or $100 a month, and so I guess going out and working, you have two kids, you got to go out there and work. You mostly played the B3, the Hammond organ. So how many songs in a night would you play? How many different songs?
Well, like you said, we did 5 hours, and so in an hour, we'd get 10 or 15 minutes off during each hour, take a break for the cause, pause for the cause. We had all the wraps down, and so I suppose that we must have played about 12 or 14 songs every hour. So I don't know, to add it up, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have any recordings of those days? Because,
No, I remember a guy who... Scout from a record company came in one night, and he said, this sounds good. Let me just bring my tape recorder in. And so when he brings the recorder in, our guitar player says, I'm not going to play this set. I can't just record my licks.
He didn't want to have his licks stolen?
He took his recorder back out to the car.
Oh, my God. That's interesting. I mean, because I guess in some ways it did seem so disposable. You're playing 5 hours a night. How precious can it be? But I'd love to hear one, you were there type of moment.
Well, we kind of, because we did get those one-off record single releases, and there are some of those things out there that we did with the band. I basically had the same band from, it was Teddy's band, that Teddy Mendazzo, and we'd play 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off in Vegas and other places. And when we weren't working with him in between, we'd come to L.A. and we'd work as a quartet with me singing and playing the organ.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, in this book, is that you are a hard worker. I mean, that's part of it. You just worked a lot. You didn't say no a lot, and you tried to fulfill what people needed. And, you're in L.A. where people need music for stuff all the time. Like the Days of Our Lives theme, which was on the air for 50 years, which...
Still going. Knock on wood.
Amazing. So how does publishing work? Let's just talk about that briefly. You write a song and you get paid for 50 years. Is that how it works?
Well, you get paid from a couple of sources. One is for every record that sells. Now, these days, of course, everybody thinks music should be free, and hardly are records selling. And so it's not the same. But in those days, it's a statutory rate set by Congress. And in those days, we were getting a penny, and that penny would be split half to the publisher, and then half a penny would go split between the writers.
Wow.
And then, but the second way is you get paid from what they call performance rights organizations, and they collect money every time a record's played on television or in the movies. And then the third source is if you get it in a movie, then that's a sync fee, and that's like a lump sum thing, a movie or a commercial, and that comes in handy nice.
And your records really are part of that soundtrack of the 60s, so whenever anybody wants to make a movie taking place in the 60s, there's a lot of co-writes of yours in being used today,
We get those wonderful surprises from time to time. In fact, the new Disney Nature movie called Monkey Kingdom is out, and they use the Monkeys theme, not only in the... They paid more, actually, to use it in the trailer for the movie, but they also used it in the opening of the movie.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, it's a great... I mean, is the catchiest song ever written, perhaps. So.
Yeah, it probably is the most lucrative song, yeah. Other than Days of Our Lives, which plays 5 days a week, and that's National Network TV, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's... Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. At one point in the book, you say that Boyce and Hart... You became a runaway train. Sort of, you stopped working with the Monkees, and you guys decided, let's do our own thing for real. And then you say it became a runaway train quickly. What happened?
Well, I think any group that gets really popular quickly, it goes through this. But we were doing not only records for other people producing, but we were producing our own records, going on the road, doing the concerts, doing the press, doing the interviews, doing the sound checks, doing the... it becomes... a whirl in your mind, and you just, after a while, it takes a toll on the nervous system. I think there's a famous quote by George Harrison who said that the fans gave us their love and we gave them our nervous system. I mean, that's what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I can sort of imagine. Let me remind folks that we're talking to Bobby Hart here, author of this new book called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Voice and Heart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And he'll also be right here at WFMU's Monty Hall this Friday for a screening of Voice and Heart. The guys who wrote him, along with, I believe, the director and Joe Bielak, will be there, and we'll be answering some questions from folks. So I recommend...
Come out. It'll be a fun night.
Yeah, absolutely. You did this. There's a great chapter in the book, again, something I didn't know, and I'm leaving out huge swaths of the book because I think folks will really enjoy reading it, where you find a new, very dynamic manager, and you're told by people you trust, don't work with this guy.
Yeah.
It won't work out. Yeah. And he steals all your money. I mean, it's like the textbook. He actually sort of delivers in the beginning.
Oh, he delivered great.
Amazing.
He made deals that nobody else could have made, including the people that were warning us not to go with him. And we had a great run with him for about a year and a half. And he had more, you know, intricate visions for our careers than even we did. And he took us to places we never would have gone. So there's no regrets. We knew what we were getting into. But, of course, when he got us the gig to open in the main room, Flamingo Hotel in Vegas, with Zsa Zsa Gabor, that was pretty cool. But then he had this little gambling thing. So
yeah, well, it's very interesting because you're at this sort of turning point where you are now superstars, and you have a very critically successful week in Vegas, and you're about to extend that. And then this guy steals your money, and your partner Tommy says, "That's it, I can't take it." And the runaway train sort of goes off the tracks at that time.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the real loss, was you know, breaking up the partnership. And of course, the friendship survived, but it was a little rough just pulling the brake on the speeding train, like you said.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you worked immediately. You kept working, and sort of over and over again in this book, you sort of put it all back together. You start working with the Partridge Family, and you know, all kinds of things. This book is not just a show business book. It is also a book about your search for enlightenment and your search for happiness and your search for just to be calm. And there's little breaks in between some of the chapters, the stepping stones through the potholes of life, in which I can see that you're really trying hard to give practical, useful tips without, you know, beating anybody over the head with religion or some of the deeper things.
Yeah, I wanted to show, you know, it became almost an obligation. You start to see when you're writing, you don't notice while you're going through it and living your life, but when you look back on it, you see these patterns. What I could have done better, what things worked for me. So I really felt, hey, I need to share this with others, anybody who can learn from my mistakes and learn from what I did right. So we did the little stepping stone pages and shared my spiritual journey. It's not going to be, everyone has their own unique journey, but there are some parallels. And so, you know, my life was saved when I met Paramahansa Yogananda, my guru, and that was just a turning point for me, and meditation has been the way for me. It may not be for everyone, but it's at least I'm putting it out there.
And is that a daily practice for you?
Yeah, yoga has just, you know, saved my life. That's how the nervous system survived.
Hmm. That's quite a testimony. And it seems like yoga has helped you focus. I mean, focus, I think, is really one of the words in the book that...
It's true. Concentration is so important. Perseverance, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, you got to keep. Once you find your dream, you want to fine tune it as you go along. But you want to keep doing it until it materializes, and that door, that opportunity will open at some point. But you've got to be ready. You can't just say, "Oh, here it is. I'd like to do this." No, you got to be working at it.
Mm. Do you still write songs now?
Yeah, I still write, not as prolific as before, because we were working on this on Psychedelic Bubblegum for 6 years with my co-writer Glenn Ballantyne, and that's been taking our time now promoting it. So that's our focus now. Plus, we're going to be going out and doing some seminars and keynote speeches, kind of talking about those things that you've just been mentioning.
Hmm. One of the things in the book that's quite interesting is you talk about how you and Tommy would write songs, and literally you would write them walking down the street or sitting in the park or, you know, in a car on the way to pitch.
Yeah.
You know, it was really very... It sounds like having a co-writer in those situations is really important.
Well, a lot of people, you know, most of the East Coast writers that we were our contemporaries at that time, one wrote music, one wrote lyrics. We had the advantage that we both wrote both. so our reason for being together was the fun we had, you know, so why not take advantage of it? And when we got signed to Screen Gems Columbia Music and came back to California, you know, they were giving us $100 a week. Well, that was great. That paid our rent. We didn't have to worry about the day gig anymore. And so we were having a ball and being, I think that contributed to our creativity as well.
Are there songs that are for you personal milestones where along the way you said, you know, this song is a giant step forward. It's not a baby step forward. It's something that really, you know, sometimes you just sort of get handed almost mystically a giant step forward. Are there songs that kind of...
Well, I think the ones we've talked about, I think, you know, Last Train to Clarksville, when the first Monkey single that was zooming up the charts before the show even went on the air, Days of Our Lives, which has been so... lasting, and songs like I Want to Be Free, which got recorded by so many other people, that was kind of a meaningful song to us because it was one of the few that we wrote just because we felt like it one night, and not as short order cooks as I used to call ourselves. Or a project that was coming up.
Yeah, it is very interesting because in the book there's a lot of descriptions of folks say, we need a song like this, kid. And you always say we have one, and then you write it after the after the fact. You know?
Well, Tommy Boyce was the consummate salesman, you know, so besides the fun that he was to work with and to be a friend of, he was a great salesman, and that was part of his style.
Yeah, yeah. Never say no. I guess that helps. You know, one of the few things you don't really talk about in the book is how Tommy ended his. He took his own life, and was it just something you just couldn't go there?
I allude to it because I don't want people just assume, well, he was depressed. I don't think he was depressed. He had had a medical thing, you know, an aneurysm in his brain that broke, and he never got his energy back from that. And they told him inevitable this will happen again, you'll probably be a vegetable. And so, of course, there's no excuse for that, you know, but it's kind of an understanding that can come with that.
Yeah, so it's very heartbreaking, and for people close to him, I'm sure it was, devastating, yeah. Ugh. Well, it's a really interesting book, and like I said, you know, just your honesty and that stuff should be applauded. I've read a lot of these books where people don't tell what really happened, and in this book, sort of seems like you're actually telling what really happened, but gently, and you know, not in a sensational way, and so you get points for that. It's called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And Bobby will be at WFMU with copies of the book this Friday night, showing the movie. And like I said, I think folks should. It's a pretty small place with the seats, and it probably will sell out. And I recommend folks get tickets right now over at WFMU.org. It's a super interesting book, a super interesting guy, and written so many songs. I mean, when you get into the, like you said, the I Want to Be Free, you know, like 100 people, including, you know, crooners, you know, people who are serious singers who sing the American songbook, that song. You know, sure. There's so many people, the Monkees and Fats Domino and Paul Revere and the Standells and Del Shannon and Jane the Americans and Chubby Checker and Little Anthony and Gary Lewis, just, you know, and the list goes on and on. It's amazing. It really is kind of mind-boggling. Is your mind blown?
I'm just appreciative, and I look back and just to see, you know, how things transpired, and like you said, a kid comes here, nothing in his pocket, and no contacts, and just hanging in those 6 years and learning my craft, and then to look back on it all, it is pretty mind-boggling even to me.
Yeah, well, but you seem to have your feet mostly on the ground, which is... which is good. I've got this song queued up now called Girl, I'm Out to Get You. It's one of my favorite Boyce and Hart tracks. Tell me how, you know, do you remember how it was written, how it was recorded, anything about it?
You know, this was part of what we were doing, and we've talked about it. We would go off and write these songs. Oftentimes, they were for projects. You know, Jane and the Americans is coming up 2 weeks from now, and they need a song where we'd write something that sounded like Jane and the Americans. But when we got to the Monkees and then Boyce and Hart, we were pretty much just writing from our hearts and whatever was on our mind at that time.
It's kind of interesting to go full 180 from, you know, what you said, short order cooks, to trying to express yourself and send your own message out there. Yeah. And so who's, do we know who's playing on this record? Is it your regular band?
Yeah, our band, but like I said, it was Teddy's band. It was Jerry McGee and the Cajuns. The Cajuns were Larry Taylor, who later became a founding member of Canned Heat, and then Billy Lewis on drums, who was a great studio player. But when we got the Monkees project, these guys had just come back to town, so they were, had been in New York after working with Teddy, and we decided, hey, let's have a real band, a band that we've worked with in clubs and other venues for a couple of years now, and it's going to sound like a band, like a garage band, instead of the great session players, which we used on almost all the other projects. But when we did Boyce and Hart and we did the Monkees, it was the Candy Store Prophets, which formerly was Jerry McGee and the Cajuns.
Yeah, and Jerry McGee was in the Ventures for years and years. Just an amazing sort of under, you know, when people sort of reel off that list of of session guitar players from L.A., they usually don't list him, and he's mind-blowing. Yeah.
Oh, he's a great guitar player. And then for the Monkees, for our projects, we added Louis Sheldon, who went on to produce a ton of records for Seals and Croft and just became a great studio sought-after guy after we had brought him in for the Monkees. And a guy named Wayne Irwin, because we were looking for somebody who could do feedback guitar and some of those psychedelic licks.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that a lot of those Monkees records have three guitars on them, yet everybody's playing a part, and it doesn't sound like a cacophony. You know, it's
we would go in a little rehearsal studios and rehearse these things, work out the arrangements before we'd go in the expensive studios, and we treated it like a band.
Yeah. Great stuff. Let's hear Girl, I'm Out to Get You. Bobby Hart, thanks for taking a little bit of your morning to speak with us again. And I want to remind folks, they've got archives of our longer conversation over at WFMU.org/Michael. And Joe Belock's got an archive of his conversation this week. Or you could have your own conversation with Bobby this Friday night at Monty Hall and pick up a copy of the new book. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michael, it's been a pleasure, and see everybody Friday night.
It's great. Thanks so much.